Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio Show. My guest for this morning is journalist and author Anne Ma. Anne will be taking us on a tour of French food, chronicles her year-long food exploits in France, savoring one of the world's greatest cuisine. Good morning, Anne. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio.
Good morning.
How are you?
Good.
Good morning
to you.
Thank you
for having me.
Wonderful. And a Happy New Year to you as well.
Yes, Happy New Year.
It's a pleasure to have you on the air with me. Mastering the Art of French Eating is a wonderful read. It brought back memories of my time in France, so that's just wonderful. And the recipes that you included in the book are simply icing on the cake, so congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. It was really a pleasure to write this book, and it gives me great happiness to share it with people.
Wonderful. It's done very well because it's got the tremendous amount of history that you put into the book as well. So it is a very well-written book in terms of information as well as the food. And overall, the nice touch of your personal life, your memoir, because you did kind of go back and forth in terms of your times being in China as well as being elsewhere.
Yes. I've been lucky enough to live in cities like Paris, Washington, mm-hmm. D.C., and Beijing. But this book takes place in Paris and is about a year I spent there.
Interesting. So let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please kind of give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
I grew up in Southern California in Orange County, a town called Huntington Beach, and I was always a food lover. My father was and is a great home cook, and I used to sit on the kitchen counter and watch him chop garlic and cheer him on. I also always was interested in France and longed to go there and study there and travel there. So when my husband and I received this assignment to go to Paris for 3 years, we were both completely overjoyed.
That's fantastic. One of the things that you talk about in comparing your last post in China versus Paris, where even though you enjoyed living in China, you find yourself kind of out of place, even though you're Chinese.
I am ethnically Chinese, but I was born in the States and grew up in the States, as did my father. So I feel culturally very American, which I think is the case for many people. One thing that really struck me living in China was how I was considered immediately Chinese, as if I was a native Chinese, and how I was expected to behave culturally as a native Chinese, even though for me the culture was very different.
Very interesting. So when did you discover you like to write?
Well, I always loved to read, and I think reading and writing, writing starts with reading. When I was a very little girl, I remember my brother, who is 9 years older than me, was reading a book and kind of making fun of me because I couldn't read, and I got so angry with him. I hit him over the head with a jump rope. I got in trouble for that. But my reward was that my aunt taught me how to read a few days later. I began to learn how to read. And after that, I always wrote little stories as a little girl and wrote for the college newspaper. I had a column, a bi-weekly column in the college newspaper. But I never had the courage, really, to become a writer because it requires so much, really, a thick skin and a lot of discipline and hard work. There's a lot of disappointment involved. There's a lot of rejection. You make no money doing it. I never had really the courage to realize my dream until I found myself in Beijing, newly married, as a trailing spouse, I gave up my job to move with my husband for his career as a diplomat, and I needed a job of my own that was portable. And, you know, with some luck and perseverance, a lot of perseverance, I eventually found my way to writing for a local magazine and then freelancing for larger U.S. publications from there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. What life experiences influence your writing most?
Well, I would say absolutely living overseas has been reflected in the things that I've written about,
mm-hmm.
both my travel articles, but also my novel, which was published by HarperCollins in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Kitchen Chinese, and that tells the story of a young woman who discovers China through its cuisine. And then this book, Mastering the Art of French Eating, is also very similar in that food is a theme and a strong metaphor. A way to discover a new place, a new culture, a history that is, you know, different from your own, a way to meet people and to connect with others. Yeah, living overseas has been one of the most wonderful and also challenging things that I've done in my life. We move all the time. We move every three
mm-hmm.
or 4 years,
mm-hmm.
and that requires a reinvention every time.
That's wonderful. One of the things that I've always considered as windows to the world, besides languages, are obviously food. And we're talking about basic food groups here in terms of the normal chicken, pork, beef, seafood, and so forth. And we're not talking about exotic food. Of course, exotic food are signature dishes for the different parts of the world. Certainly, having the opportunity to see how the different dishes cook using the same ingredients is quite fascinating for you.
Absolutely. Just one of the things I love about travel or traveling in one country, within one
mm-hmm.
country, is watching, observing the different regions and how different they are from each other. France is a small place,
mm-hmm.
but each region is very proud, and each region has a very distinct cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
So even though, you know, two regions might be right next door to each other, using some of the same vegetables or other
mm-hmm.
products, they prepare them in very different ways.
Interesting. Who are some of your favorite writers?
As I said, I grew up reading, and I think, you know, like so many food writers, I was influenced by the food I read about in children's books, like
mm-hmm.
In Anne of Green Gables. The, you know, she has all these cooking disasters, and she gets her little friend drunk on raspberry wine instead of raspberry cordial, or blackcurrant wine instead of raspberry cordial. And I always wondered, you know, what do these things taste like? The biscuits that were light as a feather, and the layer cake,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, of which she accidentally. And then moving on from there, I have loved, Peter Mayle is definitely an inspiration for me. His books are so charming and funny, but also really warm, and I feel like
mm-hmm.
he really knows Provence so well and is, you know, writes about it in such a fond and touching way. And then one of my very, very favorite authors is Marcel Pagnol, who is also a film director. He had his heyday in the 1930s and 40s. He is from Marseille, in France, from the south, also, you know, in Provence. And two books that he wrote that I love are his memoirs called The Glory of My Father and The Chateau of My Mother. And they are a pair of memoirs that talk about his childhood spent in the backcountry above Marseille, and all the hunting that they did and the adventures he had with his little friends and his father. And they're just a very poignant reminder of a way of life that doesn't exist anymore, that didn't even exist anymore by the time he was an old man and writing these books. They're very nostalgic and sweet.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Your first book, your first novel, Kitchen Chinese, was a critically acclaimed book. How difficult was it for you to switch gears from writing a novel to a memoir?
It was quite difficult. One of the hardest parts about writing a memoir is, you know, writing about the feelings and emotions that are felt, so, you know, that are so raw to you, and making them relatable and comprehensible to other people. In memoir writing, there's really nowhere to hide. Whereas in fiction, obviously, you can create, you know, there's a lot of use of metaphor and other ways to sort of, you're not really putting your own self on the line. But in memoir writing, there is absolutely nowhere to hide. And even if you enhance a scene for dramatic effect, it will be read as the honest to God, you know, literal truth, no matter, you know, for exaggeration or dramatic effect. Yeah. If you take that license, you have to be aware that many people are going to read it very literally.
Right. Well, in just reading your book, Mastering the Art of French Eating, and, of course, just talking to you for a little bit right now, I'm sure there's a lot of you in kitchen Chinese as well, even though it is a novel, but I'm sure you are able to sort of live a role or two in that book and a character in the book that sort of disguises you very well, and you're able to express yourself accordingly.
That book, it was definitely a roman à clé, based on my experiences of living in Beijing, which I thought was an important, to discover even more cultural issues about dating, which was very interesting to me and is very interesting, intercultural relationships. But also, the main character of Kitchen Chinese has a sister, and the two of them have a very complex relationship, and I'm not lucky enough to have a sister.
I see. Why did you decide to write a book about French eating?
Well, the idea came to me, it came to me almost fully formed when I was in the shower one day. I think I get all my best ideas in the shower, about a book using Julia Child's classic cookbook, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, as a guide to travel around France. I found myself alone in Paris for a year, a few months after my husband and I arrived for his diplomatic assignment at the American Embassy. He was called away to Baghdad for a year, and I found myself alone wanting a way to really explore, to continue to explore the country for the limited time that I had to stay in France. To really experience it and to realize my dream of traveling around the country and eating. So that was really the root of the book. But from my research, I met so many wonderful people who were so generous and really made France feel like home to me.
Very interesting. How did Julia Child's life and exploits contribute to your book?
Well, Julia Child is a great inspiration, obviously an impassioned cook and very knowledgeable. She worked very hard to gain that knowledge, studied extremely carefully the classic technique, and had a great respect for French cuisine. And through it all, managed to carve out a career for herself that was extraordinarily successful. I could never compare myself to Julia Child. I admire her very greatly. Her marriage to Paul, which was, unwavering and in which they really supported each other. I admire that so much. And I also admire her perseverance at getting her cookbook published.
We were talking about Julia Child's life and exploits contributing to your book, and you mentioned something about the fact that you're both married to husbands that work for the State Department, basically, and travel extensively and so forth. At what point in time did you feel that was kind of a fun thing to do, being able to travel extensively?
Well, I had never done much traveling alone before I started researching this book. But when my husband left for Baghdad, I was encouraged by him and also a few friends who I had, a friend I had met in Paris. She and my husband really encouraged me to make the most of the time I had in France and to to still, you know, travel to different places, even if it meant going on my own, and explore. And I'm very grateful to her and to my husband for being so supportive. I wouldn't say that traveling in France takes a tremendous amount of courage. You know, it's a developed country with a great infrastructure.
Right.
But there is a certain, I guess, emotional hurdle to get over about traveling alone. And in the end, I grew to prefer it to go on my research trips by myself. It gave me the freedom to, you know, run off and meet with a winemaker, you know, to make my own schedule, to seize opportunities as they came, instead of having to check with my travel companion if that was okay.
Right. Interesting. So how did you overcome your hesitation of traveling and dining alone?
Well, you know, the first trip I made alone was to Brittany, and my friend Elena, who is I write about in this chapter of the book, really said to me, you know, I think you should just go and make the most of your time and profit, as they say in French, profiter, from the time you have. And so I just did it. I booked a train ticket and rented a car, which was another little bit of a hurdle. I had, you know, never rented a car and driven, you know, on roads unknown to me before in a foreign country. But I just did it, and and I was welcomed by a woman who makes butter. She's a dairy farmer, and she makes a special kind of Breton butter. I was welcomed by older women who were experts in making crepe, who, you know, handed me packages of crepe to take back to Paris with me. And I was welcomed by the owners of the bed and breakfast I stayed at. And people were so warm and so eager to share their culture and their food and their stories with me that first trip really gave me a lot of confidence. And a funny note about renting a car, actually, which is I don't really talk about in the book, I do touch on just very briefly, is that in France, most cars are manual shift, and I can only drive an automatic. So that would really, really hampered me and the types, you know, the kinds of cars that I got, which were always the most, you know, run down, beat up, dirty old cars that they happened to have left in the lot, the only automatic that I would beg for. I've waited, you know, 2 or 3 hours for the only automatic in the fleet to come back. I've been given huge vans for 8 people that seat 8 people for just me to drive around in because they had no other automatic car. So I guess if anyone asked me for advice on becoming a travel writer and, you know, becoming a great traveler, I would say learn how to drive a manual shift.
Very interesting. Coming back to your writings, do you use your writing as an escape to express yourself or just to entertain others?
I would say it's my eagerness to share the stories that I find. I met so many wonderful people who shared their childhood stories. There was a woman, a family who invited me into their home in Brittany to make me cut for lunch. All of, you know, the mother and father were a little older than me, and they both grew up in Brittany, and they told me stories about their childhood, about going to the village crepe shop and how they would pinch off a little corner of each crepe you ate so they knew how much to charge you at the end of the day. Or the wife, she would carry pats of butter to the village, to her village crepe shop, you know, 3 or 4 pats of butter, and that's how the crepe owner knew how many crepe to give her that her mother had paid for or would pay for later. And just finding these really charming stories that were, you know, didn't happen that long ago, you know, maybe 20, 25 years ago, but seem just incredibly old-fashioned. I really wanted to share those tales.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And I'm glad that you talk a little bit about being able to meet the individual people, whether it's being invited to a private home and so forth, because in the end, it's all about people, meeting people around the world, the warmth, the natural connection, human to human, and the genuineness of all these people that are very grateful that you are interested in their culture.
Yes. I mean, they were very touched that I was interested, mm-hmm. but I was also very touched that by, you know, their willingness to share. Although in some circumstances, there was a little bit of suspicion. For example, when I helped cook for a village fête, mm-hmm. a village party in Provence, I helped
yeah.
make soup au pis stew, which is like a minestrone soup, for mm-hmm. about 200 people. And I got up at 5:30 in the morning to join a group of Provençal women.
Mm-hmm.
They were all friends and members of a local boule club,
mm-hmm.
Pétanque
mm-hmm.
club. And I joined them, and, you know, we each had brought our own cutting board and our own vegetable peeler and our own knife. And
mm-hmm.
they were quite suspicious of me initially. You know, who is this woman who says she's American but doesn't look American, and says she's interested in learning about soup au pis stew but doesn't mm-hmm. you know really know anything about it,
mm-hmm.
and wants to learn our secret recipes. But after I worked very, very hard to win
mm-hmm.
them over, and I'm not, you know, I think. Just after a few hours of really hard work, they softened towards me a little bit, and I was able to really get to know them a little bit better and to enjoy their soup, which was really very, very delicious. And then once we got to the actual party, which happened at lunchtime, they were like old friends. We greeted each other from across the village square with, you know, great waves as if we'd known each other for years. So, you know, it wasn't always easy to find people to talk to share their recipes and their stories,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
the perseverance definitely paid off.
I'm sure it does. And, of course, nothing beats a handshake than a good meal.
That's true. That is true.
What would you like for your readers to gain from reading Mastering the Art of French Eating?
Well, I think for me, I hope that it inspires people to travel, especially in
mm-hmm.
France, outside of Paris. You know, most people go to France or think of France and they think only of Paris. But
nice.
The provinces are very beautiful, rich in history. They're not always easy to get to, although France has a wonderful train system,
mm-hmm.
Which is easy to navigate. And, you know, people don't always speak English outside of Paris, but they are really worth a visit just to uncover something different, a different culture that's, you know, Paris is a world city. The provinces, the countryside is still quite rural, and people there are very proud and very eager
mm-hmm.
to share.
Mm-hmm.
I hope it also encourages people to ask questions, to, you know, not be shy about going to a new place and you know, if you see something you don't understand on the menu, to ask what it is. And I hope that people really my dream would be for people to read the book and really want to explore France a little more.
Right. One of the things that I do remember being in France, the time that I was there, they do provide me with translators, and of course we were hosted by the mayor of Paris, all the government officials in the various cities that I went to. But at the times that I had the opportunity to just go out on my own
mm-hmm.
and just experience real life, real situation, and I find that the people are very friendly, and they really appreciate the fact that you make an attempt to speak French.
Yes, absolutely.
Right, and they are much more appreciative of that rather than just trying to sort of like, okay, well, do you speak English?
Absolutely.
attitude.
I mean, I think that learning to say a few words of the local language is a great sign of respect no matter where
That's right.
you are traveling.
That's right. That's right.
And I hope my book, you know, I before I moved to Paris, I was lucky enough to spend a 7-week immersion at Middlebury College in Vermont, where I did, you know, it was a complete immersion and an academic year of French in in only 7 weeks. So I was very lucky to have that foundation. My French just only improved from there. But even if you don't have that, just to make the effort to learn how to say hello and goodbye and thank you, and also do you speak English in the local language, I think really goes a long way.
They are very polite people in France, and so I think it's just a matter of whether how you want to come across in reaching out and connect with people. And another thing, you're talking about eating alone and so forth. You're never alone because they don't usually give you a table for yourself. So it's sort of a communal eating, if I recall.
I mean, I think that France is French people can be very formal. They put a lot of stock into proper greetings when you always when you enter a shop to say bonjour, excuse me for bothering you if you have a question before you ask your question. And, you know, even among friends, they're quite formal. You know, they don't really invite each other into their kitchens, for example, to help each other, you know, to cooking together as friends is not really something that they do. They invite you over for dinner, but you never really see the kitchen. The kitchen is a private part of the house. I think that I do think that the their eating is viewed as a communal activity, a way to relax and enjoy each other's company. You know, it's not just the food and it's not just the people who surround you. It's a combination of both. And for that reason, it is rare to see people eating alone in restaurants, but it does happen.
Right. I'm not saying it doesn't, but usually, I mean, you have an opportunity to meet someone, total strangers, that might be sharing a table with you.
And especially in Paris, restaurants are very small, and so, you know, you often find yourself seated very close to each other. Also in Lyon, the classic restaurant of Lyon is called a bouchon, and they are known for seating patrons elbow to elbow and for being very convivial places where people, you know, in the 18th and 19th centuries, that they were a gathering place for silk workers. And they were sort of like little clubs where all stratas of the pyramid of the silk worker industry met, from the very top, the very wealthy financiers, to the very bottom, the very poor actual laborers. They all mingled at these restaurants called bouchon. And they were known as sort of, a level ground.
Right.
And that atmosphere in the great classic bouchon of Lyon still very much exists, where it's just a very friendly, convivial atmosphere where there might be, you know, a regular patron who's brought his guitar along and plays a song at the end of the night. And, you know, people are really wanting to give you an introduction to what you're eating and to the history of the restaurant. So that for anyone, you know, I would actually say traveling alone, Lyon would be a wonderful place to experience the bouchon.
Wonderful. Were there challenges in writing the book?
I mean, I think the greatest challenge for me was, as I said a little earlier, opening up more emotionally about the personal story. The best part of the book was traveling and meeting people and doing the actual research. And I've tied that together with my own story of feeling a little isolated at times and having to overcome that. I think that was a great challenge, but as someone said to me, a good friend said to me that some of the best writing comes from a place of vulnerability. So, you know, I hope that people connect to those parts of the story as well. Although, you know, I hope that people are able to relate to them.
Interesting. What was the most rewarding experience in writing the book?
I'd say the most rewarding experience was the actual travel and discovery, the way the history really became evident to me once I visited a place. I had done so much research, reading about places and different books and cookbooks and, you know, old antique cookbooks and encyclopedias of food, you know, La Russe Gastronomique, that sort of thing. But once you're actually there, everything really starts to make sense. And I think that that, for me, was one of the most wonderful experiences.
Very interesting. How did you go about in choosing the 10 regions and their signature dishes you highlighted in the book?
Well, I really wanted to pick dishes that were famous in the United States. And so the book opens with steak frites, which I think everyone thinks of when they think of Paris, a little bistro with a red check tablecloth, a grumpy waiter, a glass of wine, you know, a plate of steak and fries that are really hot. And crunchy. And so it opens with that, and it moves on to Andouillette, which is tripe sausage, which may not be as famous here in the United States, but is absolutely beloved in France by some, not by all. And which is also many Americans have made the mistake of ordering Andouillette, thinking it was Andouille, which is a sausage from New Orleans.
That's right.
Andouillette is very, very different from Andouille. It is made of tripe. It has a very, very pungent, powerful smell, like a baby's unchanged diaper, I like to say. and it has a very distinct texture as well. It's extremely rubbery. And then, you know, from there, I went on to Brittany, as we talked about, to learn about buckwheat galette and crepe. In Lyon, I discovered Salade Lyonnaise, which is really a jumping-off point to learn more about the bouchon that we were just talking about. In Provence, there is soupe au pistou, which is very, very similar to minestrone because it's a soup, a vegetable soup laced with pesto, but they're very sensitive about the similarity to Italian cuisine. France and Italy are, you know, very distinct places. So never, ever compare the two should you be visiting either place. I also visited the Languedoc or the Southwest to discover cassoulet, which is one of the great classic dishes of French country cooking. It's a great pot of beans that's simmered very, very slowly with sausage and confit de canard until everything is really meltingly tender. And then there was also Alsace, which is in the very far east of France. It borders Germany, and the dish I learned about there is called choucroute garnie, which is really sauerkraut piled with all different kinds of cured pork, ham and sausage and pork belly, smoked pork belly. The influence on the cuisine is extremely Germanic. And in fact, they speak their own language there called Alsatian or Alsacien, and which has its roots in Swiss German. It's not similar at all to French. And then I also visited Burgundy to learn about Boeuf Bourguignon, which is, of course, Julia Child's classic dish, the first dish she ever cooked on her TV show, The French Cook. And I really wanted to learn about this marriage of beef and wine. And what was surprising to me there is I discovered that it's the two products that are very famous in the region, not just wine, but also a special kind of cattle called the Charolais beef. And then I also discovered Aligot, which is not a dish famous anywhere outside of France. It's a potato dish from the Aveyron, which is a region in south central France that is, they call it, you know, deep France. It's a remote region that's quite difficult to reach by public transportation. You really need a car to get there, or it's easiest to reach by car. And so it's quite, you know, it's relatively untouristed even to this day. And their famous dish is called aligo. It's a dish of mashed potatoes that have been beaten with a special kind of cheese and like a fresh, it's almost like mozzarella, but it's like a fresh cheese curd until it's very, very, you know, it's very liquid and molten like lava. It's delicious. And I wanted to include that because it not only ties back into Paris, where most of the cafes are owned by people from the Aveyron, immigrants to the capital who were very poor during the 18th and 19th century, who came to Paris to make their fortunes and really established the culture of cafes. The most famous cafes in Paris that we know today are all Aveyronais. And also because some of our best friends own a cafe in the 20th. It's called the Mistral. And they are like our French family, and they were really a support to me while my husband was away. And I wanted to sort of bring the story full circle from opening with them, not really knowing them that well, to the finish when we're all preparing Thanksgiving dinner together and this sort of celebration of being together once again as a family.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. You have, as I mentioned before, a lot of history in the book as well, which I love. Do you do a lot of research in order to get the history information into the book?
Absolutely. You know, not just through talking with people, but also through reading, both in French and in English. I love browsing through old cookbook stores to find, you know, the traditional recipes or, you know, old recipes, which are always written in a very funny way and have interesting headnotes sometimes. But also reading magazine articles, journal articles, both in French and in English. The history is very interesting to me. One of my favorite parts about traveling through France and anywhere is the connection between history and culture and food. And the way a recipe takes root from the land, from the produce that's grown there, and is, you know, that's the spark that begins a recipe, and the way it takes root and then is cooked and eaten and grown in the same place for hundreds of years. That's one of my favorite things about France. it's fascinating to me, but it's also a lot of research. Mm-hmm.
We talk a little bit about the city of Troyes. And, of course, besides Andillette de Troyes, what else do you enjoy being in the city of Troyes?
Well, I love Troyes. It's a town that is in the Champagne region of France, so it makes a good pairing if you go to the actual Champagne-producing region like Reims. You can make a side trip to Troyes. It's a medieval town with a very, very charming historic center that's beautifully preserved. Lots of half-timber houses and a river that runs through the center of the town. Cobblestone streets. It's very well kept, very manicured. And it's just it's like stepping back in time a little bit to another era, to, you know, the 17th century. You really get a feel for and they also have a beautiful cathedral there.
Right. One of the things that I enjoy going up and down, I guess, taking the TGV from Paris down to Marseille, and in this case, I'm trying to figure out how we got to the city of Troyes, but you're right, because you can just sort of transport yourself out of the quote-unquote 20th century city life. You arrive at these beautiful small cities, and they're not small by all means, but they're well kept, preserved in time. And one of the things that I encountered when I was in Provence was like you could be in the city and yet any moment now, remembering that when I was growing up I watched a lot of those World War II movies, you can have a tank just coming around the corner. It gives you that sense of just a different feeling.
It is. I think it's, you know, I live in New York now, which is one of my favorite cities, but Paris and New York are very different places. You really do get a feeling of history and elegance in Paris, a feeling that you could be stepping back in time when you go, you know, when you're walking down a narrow street at dusk and the lamps are very, you know, very yellow, that casting that yellow light. And, you know, the buildings are almost ancient. Some of them date, some of the earliest buildings date to the 1600s, and people still live in them. New York is very different. It has a great energy, and it's always changing. There's always construction, buildings being torn down and built back up again. So the two are very different. And I think that feeling of you know, sort of being lost in time is even more prevalent in the countryside or in small towns in France. But then, of course, there are the industrial zones that surround these towns, like Troyes has a very large industrial zone where there is an Andriette factory that I visited. And then there are also commercial zones that surround these cities. So I think they're a little different in that the historic centers are usually quite well preserved and very charming. And then for the great big box stores, the mega stores, they put those a little bit outside of town.
Right.
And they are just strip malls like you would find anywhere else.
Right. It's well planned in many ways. And you can truly appreciate when you go to France, and especially in the Provence area where I'm kind of familiar with. By the way, that's where Cézanne is from, Aix-en-Provence. And when you enjoy his paintings and when you go to areas like that, it gives you a different meaning in terms of being able to see the painting and then to see the actual area.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite things about Aix-en-Provence in relation to Cézanne is visiting his workshop, his atelier, where it's preserved as if he had just stepped out the door. And some of his still lives, you know, you can recognize the objects that he used to paint, the vases and bowls and mirrors and different things that feature so prominently in so many of his works. Are there, and you see, you sort of really get a sense of how he was inspired and how his oeuvre developed. And not just that, not just within his studio, but also the landscape. Mont Saint-Victoire is very prominent in the landscape of the region, and it really looms very, you know, it looms high over the city. And so when you're there, you really do get a sense of the influence that this mountain had on him and probably everyone who was living with him at the day, you know, during the time.
Right, right. I think Gauguin was also from Provence region, if I'm not mistaken.
Gauguin painted, I believe, in Arles, which is also in Provence. But Gauguin... I believe Gauguin was from Paris and then became a painter quite late in life, And one of the first places he visited before going to Tahiti, where he painted his most famous pieces, was Brittany. And some of my favorite Gauguin paintings are actually of Breton women, girls, dressed up in traditional costume, although at that time, back in the day, that was probably the way they dressed every day, doing, you know, they're wearing clogs and headscarves and aprons, brightly colored dresses, and doing traditional dances. And, you know, for festivals and special occasions, people still do dress up in their traditional costumes in different regions of France. And it's always a treat to see them.
Right. Can you share with us your experience of eating ortolans in Provence region?
Oh, the ortolans.
Yes.
Ortolans are a little bird, a very tiny little bird about the size of a golf ball. And they are very rare. I'm not sure if ortolans are even legal today to eat them. But actually, Marcel Tagnol, the author and film director who I spoke of earlier, writes extensively about them in his book, The Glory of My Father. They're little birds, tiny little birds that you trap in these little snap traps that you bait with winged ants. And you catch the ants, and then you bait the trap. And to do this is very traditional, and people are very nostalgic for it. I was lucky enough as a child to travel to Provence with my parents, where we visited a student of my father's named Bernard, who grew up like Marcel Pagnol in the backcountry of Marseille. It's like this hill country. And trapping and eating ortolan were also part of his childhood. And so I didn't know it at the time that I was partaking in this sort of wonderful tradition that's, mm-hmm. you know, this wonderful regional tradition. But Bernard had trapped the ortolan, I think, the summer before and had them in the freezer. And, he loved my father as his professor, and so he wanted to prepare this special meal for him. And so he had his wife, Véronique, who's a great cook, prepare the ortolans, and you eat them whole, and you crunch through everything, the little bones and everything, like a little cracker. And I just remember, I was a child at the time, so my memories are not incredibly strong, but I do remember knowing that it was a very special experience and not really understanding why, but... strangely, not being disgusted by it, but being really fascinated by it.
The reason why I brought that story up is because the importance of the fact that you had the opportunity to go there with your parents and how life goes into full circle. You were able to go back to France, in this case, when you're an adult.
Absolutely. My parents... I was very lucky to travel with my parents to France when I was about 12 years old. And in fact, the first time I ever visited Paris as a child, an even younger child, was with my parents. And so they're absolutely part of my memories of Paris, being in Paris in the middle of a heat wave and being acutely uncomfortable because there was no air conditioning. And that, you know, as a child of the American suburbs, was not really something I had experienced before. I definitely think that those memories are tied in with my eventual travels throughout France too.
Interesting. What surprises you most in your encounters with French chefs, restaurant owners, and culinary experts?
I think that one of the hardest parts about being a small business owner in France are the taxes, which have only increased over the past, you know, a few years, especially with the President Hollande in office, and a lot of people who are entrepreneurs who are really trying to make a go of owning a small business are really suffering. Mm-hmm. I think that along with the taxes that are faced, there are the same challenges faced anywhere in the world of globalization and, the big stores cutting out the little guy, even the charcutier who I met in Troyes, who is a prize-winning Andouillette maker, and he also has prize-winning other charcuterie, really feels the pinch of people going to shop in the big supermarkets and, you know, not wanting to spend quite a few. I mean, his products are quite a bit more expensive than what you would find in the the local big box superstore. So I think that there are a lot of challenges and that people, I think also what surprises me is that some people really persevere and some people are very discouraged by it, like anywhere. It is not easy. I think France is a very, very hard place to own a small business.
Interesting. You also talk about the eating habits of French people versus Americans, and one of the things is that we talk about earlier in the sense that the French people approach food in a different manner versus, say, we here in the United States, where we eat food in so many ways, especially lunchtime, for convenience sake. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, one of the things that I was so lucky to do while I was living in Paris was to work at the American Library of Paris, which is a membership library, a wonderful community center. And I was thrilled to really, you know, set down a little route for myself in Paris to have a job to go to have a commute, to have colleagues who are French. I spoke French at the time, and I didn't really stop to consider the cultural differences in the work environment. But one thing that surprised me so much was the idea, was the way in which people ate lunch at my office. Whereas I had, begun my career in New York City eating lunch at my desk or going out for a business lunch, people in France never ate at their desk and really took that hour for themselves. If they did just have a quick bite, they would eat it in the kitchen at the table with a knife, proper knife and fork, a real glass, and a napkin and, real cutlery, and they would take their time and eat, and then they would go for a walk, and they would use the entire lunch hour as a way to revive for the rest of the day. For me, as an American, I was used to eating something very hastily at my desk, and I still am. Since I moved back to New York, it's struck me even more watching people eat on the street. In France, yeah. You rarely see people eating on the street or eating something out of their hand. They prefer to eat everything with a knife and fork while sitting at a table, even hamburgers or pizza. I once even saw someone in Paris eating a bagel with lox and cream cheese with a knife and fork. Here in New York, I've seen people eating everything on the street, from fruit salad, pizza. I saw a woman eating sushi on the street the other day. So it's just a very, very different philosophy of eating. Not to say one is good or one is bad. It's just very different.
Here we tend to eat food in terms of, we got to eat. We're hungry. We got to just fill up and so forth. And the way you're talking about in France, where there's a sense of appreciation of the sustenance of life. So there's a respect for the food and having that little nice time out. It's a me time of recomposing myself and so forth.
I mean, I think here people really, especially in the last 10 years, people have started to appreciate cooking and local produce and, heritage meats more and more. So I do think there is a real appreciation of good food and good food raised in a responsible manner that tastes better. But I think that lunch is a great example of people, Americans really like to eat lunch at their desk, and I like to do it too. It just, that is, that's a way to, not that it's mindless, but that is a way that is just, ingrained in me. Whereas in France, lunch is, and all meals are eaten at a table.
Interesting. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Absolutely. Visit my website, www.annemaugh.net. My book is available at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, all the online retailers. And I'm also on Twitter at AnnemaughNet and also Facebook, AnnemaughAuthor. Author. Yeah.
Fantastic. How has writing Mastering the Art of French Eating impacted you personally?
I think it's really given me a great sense of even more of an appreciation for the connection between history and culture and cuisine, as we spoke about briefly. The idea that a recipe survives and changes, but can still be authentic.
Fantastic. What can we expect from you in 2014?
Well, I'm doing some more travel writing, some more travel articles. I hope to do one on France and also maybe one in Italy. And I'm also, I was writing a novel before I started writing this book about a female sommelier, and I really, really hope to get back to it.
Fantastic. We're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
Absolutely. I think my recipe for living would be, take, a great pinch of curiosity and open-heartedness and just sort of appetite and mix it all together. Don't pay too much attention to the instructions, because that's not really the way I cook with precise measurements. But to, you know, cook with patience and consciousness and love, and appreciate and enjoy life that way.
Fantastic. And thank you for the wonderful recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on FMMK Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Sarah Etheridge. She is the number one global recording artist, founder of Begal Records, and an inspirational keynote speaker. Sarah and I will be talking about how we can stay inspired, overcome our hardship, and empower ourselves and others in 2014. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. And it has been a pleasure. Thank you again and have a blessed day.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.